The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Hi there. We thought we'd start the night. I'd just read a little taste of the book. So I'm going to start from the top. This is quite the hand-carved stand. Very sensuous. Okay, here we go. When all is said and done, killing my mother came easily. Dementia, as it descends, has a way of revealing the core of the person affected by it. My mother's core was rotten, like the brackish water at the bottom of a weeks-old vase of flowers. She had been beautiful when my father met her, and still capable of love when I became their late-in-life child. But by the time she gazed up at me that day, none of this mattered. If I hadn't picked up my ringing phone, Mrs. Castle, my mother's unlucky neighbor, would have continued down the list of emergency numbers posted on my mother's almond-colored fridge. But within the hour, I found myself rushing over to the house where I was born. It was a cool October morning. When I arrived, my mother was sitting upright in her wing chair, wrapped in a mohair shawl and mumbling to herself. Mrs. Castle said my mother hadn't recognized her that morning when she'd brought the paper to the door. She tried to slam the door on me, Mrs. Castle said. She screamed like I was scalding her. It was the most pitiful thing imaginable. My mother sat, a totemic presence, in the flocked red and white wing chair in which she'd spent the more than two decades since my father's death. She'd aged slowly in the chair, retiring first to read books and work her needlepoint, and then, when her eyes began to fail, to watch public television from dawn until she fell asleep in front of it after her evening meal. In the last year or two, she would sit in the chair and not even bother to turn on the television. Often she placed the twisted skeins of yarn that my older daughter, Emily, still sent each Christmas in the center of her lap. She petted them the way some old women might pet cats. I thanked Mrs. Castle and assured her I would handle everything. "You know, it's time," she said, turning toward me on the front stoop. "She's been in the house alone an awfully long while." "I know," I said, and shut the door. Mrs. Castle walked down the steps of my mother's front porch with three empty dishes of various sizes she had found in the kitchen and that she claimed to be hers. I didn't doubt it. My mother's neighbors were a godsend. When I was young, my mother had railed against the Greek Orthodox Church down the road, calling its parishioners, for no reason that made sense, those stupid holy rolling poles. But it was this congregation that had often called upon its ranks to make sure the cranky old woman who had lived forever in the run-down house got fed and clothed. If occasionally she got robbed, well, it was precarious to be a woman living alone. "People are living in my walls," she had said to me more than once. But it was only when I found a condom lying beside my childhood bed that I'd put two and two together. Manny, a boy who occasionally repaired things for my mother, was bringing girls into her upstairs rooms. I had talked to Mrs. Castle and hired a locksmith. It was not my fault my mother refused to move. "Mother," I said, calling the name only I, as her sole child, had the right to call her. She looked up at me and smiled. "Bitch," she said. The thing about dementia is that sometimes you feel like the afflicted person has a tripwire to the truth, as if they can see beneath the skin you hide in. "Mother, it's Helen," I said. "I know who you are," she barked at me. Her hands clasped the curved ends of the armrests, and I could see how hard she pressed, her anger flaring up and out at me like involuntary claws. "That's good," I said. I stood there a moment longer until it felt like an established fact. She was my mother and I was her daughter. I thought we could go forward from this into our usual unpleasant encounter. I walked over to the windows and began to draw up the metal blinds by the increasingly threadbare cloth tape that bound them. Outside, the yard of my childhood was so overgrown it was difficult to make out the original shapes of the bushes and trees, those places I had played with other children until my mother's behavior began to garner a reputation outside our house. She steals, my mother said. My back was to her. I was looking at a vine that had crawled into the huge fir tree in the corner of the yard and consumed the shed where my father had once done carpentry. He had always been happiest inside that space. On my darkest days, I had come to imagine him there, laboriously sanding the round wooden globes that had replaced all his other projects. Who steals? That bitch. I knew she was talking about Mrs. Castle, the woman who daily made sure my mother had woken up, who brought her the Philadelphia Inquirer and not infrequently cut flowers from her own yard and placed them in plastic iced tea pitchers that wouldn't shatter if my mother knocked them over. That's not true, I told her. Mrs. Castle is a lovely woman who takes good care of you. What happened to my blue pigeon forge bowl? I knew the bowl and realized I had not seen it for weeks. In my youth, it had always held what I thought of as imprisoned food, walnuts and Brazil nuts and filberts that my father would crack and dig out with a tiny fork. I gave it to her, mother, I lied. You what? She's been so wonderful, and I knew she liked it, and so I just gave it to her one day when you were napping. Help doesn't come free, I felt like telling her. These people owe you nothing. My mother looked at me. It was a horrible bottomless look. She pouted first, her lower lip jutting out and then quivering. She was going to cry. I left the room and walked to the kitchen. Whenever I came, I found good reason to spend many of the hours I was supposed to be with my mother in every room of the house but the one in which she sat. Thank you.
Thank you for that reading, Alice.
Sure.
It's wonderful. Before getting specifically into The Almost Moon, I guess I want to ask you more generally about your three books, and that all three of them address rather taboo topics, rape and two egregious murders, one the murder of a child and a very brutal murder, and the other the murder of a parent. And I'm wondering if you set out to address taboo topics in your work, or if you're just naturally drawn to the darker side of life.
I don't think I specifically, create a list of taboos and say, now I'm going to do this one. But I think I've never really been interested, as I was saying to a friend of mine a couple of weeks ago, in what I call a fallible cocktail party conversation. Which I find a lot of modern fiction sounds like that to me. I'm interested in trying to understand huge things that don't make sense to me, and so I try to take those things on in my fiction. It's an intellectual pursuit for me to try to understand them. So they just happen to be things I've been interested in.
So what would be an example of a lighter topic? And I'm not asking you to name specific books, but
right. But
what you feel a lot of today's fiction addresses?
The intelligence of the author.
So how did you come up with the premise for this book?
I think almost all my books are drawn out of kind of obsessions. So, again, I have various obsessions, and then I try to search to find the voice or the character to tell a story, that springs from those obsessions. So those two things unite and bring me to some very clear place. And so I started with a difficult mother-daughter relationship, I went to that ultimate place that everyone, if they're honest, has thought about, which is, I just want to murder, that person who I also very much love and love more than anybody else. And so the what if sparks in your brain and you go from there.
Yeah. There was an interview that you did a few years ago when The Lovely Bones was released.
Did you say The Ugly Bones?
I did. I did.
All right, then.
They were very lovely. They really were. And you said that you liked Susie. You like the protagonist.
Right.
Now, Helen is a more complicated character. Can you tell us a little bit about her and also how you feel about her?
I think I inhaled a cough drop shortly before coming on stage. I love Helen, too. I mean, I think that that's kind of, if you're going to spend that many years with anyone, it would be a good thing if you love them. She is more prickly and more complex, you know, perhaps, and probably because she's 49 years old. But I have this deep, you know, respect and love for all my characters, including those characters who do absolutely very obvious black and white horrible things, like Mr. Harvey in The Lovely Bones. I think you have to be able to have compassion for each character in order to write them with any success.
Do you see parallels between Helen and Susie?
Actually, I don't think I've spent much time thinking about it. Give me a day. I'll call you.
Well, there was one thing that I guess I was thinking about when reading the book, The Almost Moon, is that they both have unlived lives. I mean, a 14-year-old generally has lived a lot, and Helen is so much about having sacrificed herself to her own mother.
Right. Well, and some, I mean, I think, metaphorically that's true, but Helen has gotten to live the other life, as opposed to for Susie. She, and at least within fiction, she actually gets to live that other life in heaven.
Yes.
So, you know, they're both living, I guess, alternative
existences
instead of their choice.
Yeah, that's interesting. So what about the relationship between Helen and her mother? We get a sense of it through your reading and the dementia, but can you tell us a little bit about their relationship going way back?
What do you mean? Like
since she was a child.
To give the history in terms of the novel, or
I guess that is what I mean. Because part of what it seems like the novel addresses is that she commits this crime in this passionate moment.
Right.
But there's a whole backstory, and the backstory is a little bit about the dementia, but it's also about growing up with this woman who is agoraphobic and mentally ill and seemingly mean-spirited.
Right. Well, I think, you know, the besides, you know, the end of her life and whatever character that might present, Claire, who is the mother in the book, is also a difficult piece of work, you know. So, and that has been the case ever since Helen was a child. And, you know, the book also hopes to address, I think, not directly, but by revealing the dynamic of it, somewhat of the price to be paid for that keeping up appearances phenomenon, which is to keep everything inside the dynamic of the household and never to share the difficulties that a family is having, so that it all looks good from the outside, that it really can become a toxic dynamic with inside the house.
One of the things that you address is the complexity between this mother-daughter relationship and how difficult it is. And mother-daughter relationships can be prickly, even if your mother is not a piece of work like Claire.
Right.
And I wonder if you've spent time, since you've spent so much time with this character, and you wrote a little bit about your relationship with your mother in Lucky, if you've thought about why the relationship seems to be so inherently complicated.
Because it's incredibly intimate. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, I think that there's, I remember when I was in my early 20s, I was dating this guy, and, you know, it was a very passionate relationship where we screamed at each other a lot in passion. And in one of our many breakups, I was at the bottom of the stairs or the top, I forget, and he was at the other end, and he screamed up or down at me, you know, the only person you've ever loved is your mother. And I just kind of, it brought me up kind of dumbstruck, and I kind of felt like saying, like, yeah? You know, like, just because... because that is, you know, the primary love relationship. And so it makes sense to me that it would also be the most fraught relationship. And it freaks me out a little bit that we tend to romanticize and idealize it as if there are no dark sides or negative sides or difficulties in it. I think that makes it a harder relationship than to have. I think once you can honestly talk about the difficulties with your mother, you can actually have a better relationship with your mother. Mm-hmm. You know.
Well, certainly, on the maternal side, I think that I've heard that more. Maybe I even feel that more. That, you know, it's okay for a child, a daughter, to be angry at his or her or her mother, but the experience of being a mother has been romanticized to a certain degree.
Yeah, and that's interesting because I think there are a lot of mothers that are working to change that too, you know, now in terms of just be a little bit more honest on both sides of it. Yeah.
So now, what about Helen's father? Can you talk a little bit about her relationship with him and how he may fit into this ultimate act that Helen commits of murdering her mom?
Well, you know, the book is about many things, and one of the things it is about is mental illness. And I think that what happens with a family where there is a person in the family who has a compelling problem is that much of the attention goes to that member of the family. And so it's almost like a gravity pull. All the children, the husband, just there's more attention paid, and often more as a result for the child, the perception is more love given. And so, you know, it changes how the child feels they're loved. And so they're always pursuing the other parent, the non-mentally ill parent, for that parent's love because they feel as if that parent is preoccupied by trying to caretake their spouse. So it talks a lot about, you know, or hopes to address a lot of what that dynamic is. And so that father has the burden of trying to care for his wife and also protect her. You know, there's that desire to protect and not reveal her pain or her issues. I think, and that's also part of what a child feels too, is to protect. So mm-hmm. Everybody's so busy protecting that they're also kind of simultaneously being destroyed.
Right.
So, yeah.
But does she ever feel any anger towards the father? Does Helen feel anger towards the father in the book?
It's in there.
As you said, the book addresses mental illness, and certainly Helen is rather preoccupied with whether she is sane or not. As we said, her mother was agoraphobic, and the father had many of his own issues, including depression. Ultimately, do you make a judgment as to whether she is ill or not? I mean, she commits an act that is crazy. Yeah, Helen.
Right.
I think,
you know, what's interesting to me is the very definition of sanity.
Yes.
And what sanity really is, you know, within a certain atmosphere, whether an act can be judged sane or insane. And a lot of that ambiguity is, again, something that I'm focused on working on with this book. And, you know, I think that one of the things I stray away from is using specific words like agoraphobia or depression, because it isolates and encapsulates. It's a shorthand, so it's functional, and it's therefore helpful, but it also it puts almost like a, what are those cake saver things, those, you know, those crystal things over both the condition and the person. I don't know. It's somehow limiting, instead of having it have this organic seepage, both in a negative sense, but also in a positive sense, which is some of the, positive things that you get are also from your parents' perversities, and your own perversities, I guess. Mm-hmm. So I do like the idea that we're all at one moment insane and sane, So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Aren't we?
People.
We sure are. No, it does rob someone of their complexity just to put a label on it.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, as we talked about earlier, you have written about your mother in Lucky, and you wrote that she suffered from panic and anxiety, that which you called flaps. Mm. Now, I know your mother is alive. She's not in a freezer. And this is a work of fiction.
Right.
But has she read the book?
She has read the book. And I think that she is a wise enough woman to know that people would be asking me this question. because the first thing she said was, people may need to identify fictional characters as real people. I do not need to do that. This is a very good book. So, that's, she started like that because she, and then her friend, there's a woman in our neighborhood that, there was a little squib in USA Today about 6 months ago that said my book was about matricide. And my mother takes a morning walk. And there's a woman who sits on her porch in the neighborhood and has said a couple times to my mother, you look pretty good for a dead woman. So my mother told her friend this, and my mother's friend got her a T-shirt that says, I am not a fictional character. So see, it's all going on in the suburbs.
Still.
Yeah.
Still. Did you feel any trepidation about giving it to her?
Oh, sure I did. Yeah. I mean, it's a difficult book, and I write about difficult topics. It is inherently easier to talk about rape for me than it is to talk about mental illness because it is something that I can feel, it's wholly owned by me, whereas the mental illness dynamic within the family is something that my parents obviously are sharing in some way. But they shared in the rape as well, so they're getting used to it. It's book three. They're tough. They've got calluses. It's okay.
So, speaking of rape, now, what is the difference
Excellent
for you?
Segue.
Very, very tacky, I apologize. What's the difference for you between writing about something that really happened to you that was violent and writing violence for and about characters that you create? What is that experience like?
If it's my story, I know the plot. Hmm. I mean, that's a huge difference when you're writing memoir. It's, at least in my case, for writing Lucky, the characters are already there. What happened is already there. So the challenge is to try to pin down as much of the truth as you can, whereas with fiction, it's kind of wide open, and there's much more creation involved. I'm inherently more drawn to writing fiction. I find it more difficult to do. I don't know if I would choose to write memoir again. I wrote it for a particular purpose. I feel that memoir is more rigorous and more conscious. Mm-hmm. There was less of a transition from the desk to the world when I was writing memoir. Mm-hmm. There's more of one when I'm working on fiction.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's interesting. How do you know, speaking more about violence, how do you know then in your fiction that you've struck an honest chord? Because it still has to resonate for you and for the reader.
For me, that's the voice. That's with this book and also with The Lovely Bones, the longest period for me was, other than writing the actual story, was to find the voice to tell the story in. So I work for a very long time with other voices and other perspectives until I find the easiest way I've found to say it is a voice that runs clear, and then that's the voice that I know is going to carry the story for me. And also a character that is strong enough to go with me into challenging material, because I try to write about things that I want to try to figure out, too. It's not as if I know what's going to happen in Chapter 7 or Chapter 8. So, you know, it's in some way, you know, I am creating this person that I am spending literally like 5 years together with. So they have to be, they have to have a lot for me to spend that much time with them.
Mm-hmm. I just have a couple of more questions, and I want to open questions to the audience, because I'm sure people would like to know some things. One is, you write that you came into existence, or I'm sorry, I read in an interview, you came to existence for your father. We've been talking a lot about mothers and daughters, but that you came to existence for your father after attention from the world. And I'm assuming that you were referring to The Lovely Bones.
A little bit for Lucky, but you just broke wide open with Lovely Bones, yes.
Can you tell us a little bit about what you meant by that, that you came into existence for your father?
I think that he's probably not unlike a lot of people, which is, you know, people in authority acknowledge your child, and then suddenly your child becomes more than your child. Mm-hmm. They become somebody who has, you know, a job and, you know, a car and a position in the world, and you know, he now takes a certain kind of delight in things that I feel a lot of, you know, pressure. He's like, I'm going to go to Barnes & Noble, look at the display, and watch it disappear. I'm like, Dad, could you just go to Barnes & Noble and look at the display and leave that other sentence alone? So he gets engaged on a professional level. It's a way of relating. When I wrote Lucky, my first book, and I shared the manuscript with my family, because instead of waiting as I did with the other two books when they were in galley, I showed it to them early because this was going to have things about them in it. My father's response was to send me a list of spelling and grammatical errors. But, you know, that is the way a man who has been a lifelong teacher showed his engagement with what I was doing, and also showed his love. And so I think part of the challenge of being a kid is to learn the language that your particular parent may speak. And it may take you until you're 40 years old to learn that language, but, you know, that's his.
Mm. Yeah. How many years did you spend writing The Almost Moon?
About 3.5.
Okay. So as you take it into the world now, do you feel protective? Do you feel protective of Helen and of the characters in it? Because writing is such a solitary experience, and you've lived alone with these characters, and now, in essence, you're sharing them.
Right. I think with The Lovely Bones, it was kind of a great watershed experience, which is I realized I have no control over anything other than what I put between hardcovers. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the nice things about being a writer, is it doesn't matter if I come out here and, you know, fall on my ass. I'm not a dancer, thank God. You know, I'm a writer, and so this is what I care about.
Mm-hmm. So. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Sure,
thank you. And Sarah, I think someone is going to be going around with a microphone. So if anyone has any questions, I'll just tell them to go this way. So let's start with the gentleman here, since you're close by.
Hello.
Hello.
You said that you wrote Lucky for a reason.
Hmm.
What was that reason?
Quite a few. I guess I made it singular. Quite a few. The major reason why I wrote it was, frankly, to clear my voice out of The Lovely Bones, which wasn't The Lovely Bones at the time, was to separate myself from Susie. I wanted to write this novel, and I also simultaneously realized I had a lot to say about rape, but that it would put too much of a freight on the character of Susie, so that I actually had two books to write. And then, you know, obviously the major reason why I even started writing The Lovely Bones is also why I ended up writing Lucky, which is, I, you know, I this sounds ridiculously unbelievable, but it really is true, which is while I was being raped, in the tunnel when I was 18 years old, I made a promise to myself that one day I was going to write a book about it. And that's one of those things that only an 18-year-old would, you know, do, because it seems so unrealistic that you would ever fulfill that. But, you know, I wrote two books about it, so. But, you know, I felt I had gone through this horrible experience. I was articulate. I had writing skill. I'd never read a book that I felt honestly represented the experience. I wished it had been there when I was 18. I felt a responsibility to put it out there. So,
questions?
Yes, back there. Thank you.
Hi, we have a group here from Rosemont College, and we're studying your book, Lucky. We were curious about the way you ended the book, the last chapter. What sort of editorial choices did you make? Why did you make them? There were a lot.
You've read this much more recently than I have.
The last chapter had a rush of detail, things that happened to you at the end.
Right.
Why did you take that path?
Well, there were two. I wanted the focus of the book to be primarily on the rape, on the trial, on that very short period of time. But I felt kind of a responsibility to the reader to give an arc forward. But I didn't want to. When the book originally came out, it was filed in a lot of bookstores under addiction and recovery, which was not a great place to have it filed. If you guys have read it, then you know why, because it really isn't a handbook on how to recover. It was a book written in some way less for a rape victim and more for people who had never known anything about rape. So I wanted it to be the experience of rape, the experience of the trial. And I did not feel like I had the perch. I'm not a psychiatrist or a sociologist to preach upon the subject, to tell people how to recover. I wanted to make it clear that I had moved forward and I had gone through difficulty, but there is no step-by-step. And I thought that the longer that I made that ending, the more I belabored that, the more focus would be on that and less on the idea of this is what a rape looks like, this is what a trial looks like. So that was really my focus for the book, much less, and then this happened. And so it was, I knew that I had to fulfill it for the reader. That's how I felt. I, as a reader, would want to know something, but I wanted to lightly touch and then find myself at Dorland at the end of the book and be able to say a few things, but not to come to some, you know, and then all's good kind of thing. At the end.
Yes, right here, please.
Hello, thank you. I was wondering, with a book like The Lovely Bones that's written so eloquently, is there anything that you're nervous about with Peter Jackson's recent film adaptation? Is there anything that you're just, you know, hoping that's, you know, done just right?
I think that if I got really involved in worrying about any specific thing, I'd be setting myself up. What I'm excited about is are going to be those surprises, those things that you know, film is able to bring to the story that you know, I wouldn't have thought of or I couldn't have imagined. I mean, you know, it's somebody else taking your work and making another piece of art out of it. You know, to sound stupid, how cool is that? You know, I mean, people act as if that's so horrible. And, I'm sure there are bad film experiences. But I also just think it's an incredible process that I get to watch. So.
Who wrote the screenplay and when will it be out?
It's slated for release late 2008, December, I think. And the screenplay was written by the infamous trio of Peter Jackson, Fran Walsh, and Philippa Boyens.
And how extensive were your conversations with them about that, about the writing, if at all?
They showed me a draft of the script, and we met and talked about it. And they've been very solicitous and asked me lots of questions. And they're good, organic people who give a shit, you know, which is not that's always nice. The case, you know. So it's a nice thing.
There's a young man back here, and then a woman over here.
Hello. When you showed your family Lucky before it was finalized, did they have the power to tell you what they didn't want you to write about them?
Oh, not at all. No, I showed it to them in galley form, as opposed to the way they saw these, which is the way it would be seen by you. They saw it in a pre-publication format, so there were very few changes that could be made at that time, so my father's spelling and grammar changes could be made. Excellent. But I thought I had to show it to them, and I gave them a letter, all of them of the same letter, which is, if this is the essence of your truth as you knew it, then I've done my job. But in no way can it be your exact truth. Everyone has their different one. And, you know, I guess I was pretty cocky and confident that it would be the essence of their truth. And they all were fine with it in that way. You know, they knew what I was doing. It's not as if it came out of nowhere, hey, I've written a book and you're in it. And, you know, particularly in my parents' case, I think they had felt alienated and isolated by being parents of a rape victim and not having any, you know, other parents they knew or articles or, you know, any resources or whatever. So, you know, they did a service as well by having their lives out there in that way.
I think this woman right here.
How did you arrive at the title of your book, The Almost Moon?
It's based on a conversation that happens in the book between the father and the daughter. The father is trying to... The daughter, when she's young, asks for the first time if the mother is basically normal. And the father is trying to explain that, you know, not everything is you know, some things are almost not whole. And they happen to be outside, and so there's the moon, and they have a conversation about that. And it goes into the idea that like the moon, your mother is always with you, even if, you know, there's no moon in the sky, the moon is there, even if you can't see it. So,
yes, the woman in the green right here.
How did you meet the screenwriters?
They called me. Yeah, no, the book was sold very early on, and then it was sold again with me not having anything to do with it. So it was originally going to be a much smaller film. Made by a young Scottish director, and then that didn't quite work out, and so it changed hands from Film 4 to Peter Jackson, and so I didn't really have anything to do with that. But, you know, in each case, I met with them after they acquired the property.
Yes, back here.
If you had not been raped when you were 18, would you have still become a writer, and how would your writing be different? What types of things? Are there other stories? What would we be reading?
I think I probably would have become a writer of some type. I was writing long before that. You know, I was your morbid kid who wrote obscene poetry when I was 11. So, you know, in some sense, my parents have been dealing with this for a very long time. This is nothing new. But to try to imagine what I would be writing if I hadn't been raped, you know, that's impossible for me to do. Yeah.
You know, the lovely
The Lovely Moans. The Ugly Bones. The Lovely Moans.
You're
don't get
a little
me to
weird.
Name your books.
I'm sorry.
No, this is kind of great because usually what people do is they conflate Lucky and the Lovely Bones. So they say the Lucky Bones,
oh,
but I have never
those
heard
were not Lucky Bones.
I've never heard the Lovely Bones and the Ugly Bones. I'm going to have
oh
to
my God,
keep
oh
a
man.
Hold of those.
That book.
Yes.
The book really was such a phenomenon. I mean, it caught on like wildfire. Did that take you by surprise? And I wonder how it just kind of changed you.
It totally took me by surprise. And I think for a long time I was so busy trying to, I have, as many people do, good girlitis, and I was so busy trying to do, you know, both the events that I had scheduled, but then also the events that kind of got scheduled on top of that. And then anything that people asked me to do. And it took me a very long time to realize that I had to say no or I'd never be able to write again. So, you know, it's a learning curve. And then eventually you said no and you get to start writing again. So, yeah.
Good. Other questions? Yes, there's a woman right here.
You have something else planned that we should be looking out for?
God, it's... Pub date was just yesterday. I have another book, and it's at home kind of waiting for my tour to be over so I can go back and work on it. Yeah.
Is it dark?
I won't say. No, we have a joke, my husband and I, that, you know, I'm waiting for the time I'm going to write the book. Our little stand-in title is The Fluffy Happy Hippie. But it hasn't happened yet.
Yes, gentleman over here.
You're from Philadelphia, and it's a context for some of your work, and I'd like you to comment on that. The other part is that Philadelphia, of course, is experiencing an enormous amount of social violence, and the relationship that you might connect between what you write about, that personal murder or rape, and our society's complicated affair. That we're involved in now?
Well, I grew up outside of Philly in the suburbs, which my friends always make sure I am very, very honest about, because if we're very far away and somebody asks me where I'm from and I say Philadelphia and they're anywhere near me, they're like, oh, yeah? I would say this, which is, you know, for me, what was interesting when The Lovely Bones came out and people were, you know, there was this weird summer where it felt like, you know, people were discovering the reality of missing girls. And, you know, missing girls were happening way before that summer and they are still happening now. I just feel like we tend to shy away from these things, and I'm not one of those people. So I'm much more interested in having those conversations and writing about those things. I think that works towards their elimination in society, at least the lessening of the alienation of those people who experience them. So,
yes, right over here.
Hello, how are you doing?
Hi.
Good evening to you.
Were you being advising in any way, shape, or form during the lensing of The Lovely Bones?
Wow. During the lensing of The Lovely Bones. I love that phrase. I've never even heard it, so that should probably answer your question. No, not at all. No. I don't know anything about filmmaking. Yes.
Back here? Gentleman back.
I thought that some of the conclusions that you came to about how mental illness affects a family were right on, and I wondered if that's just your own conclusion, if you've done some extensive research into that, or you knew that intuitively, or...
Yeah, I tend not to do research. So it is whatever you're responding to is just intuitive stuff and working with the characters and where they lead you, you know. I live with a historical novelist, so I know what research is, and I see someone doing it all the time, and I don't do it. I'm obsessed with those things, though, and I think, you know, when you're 45 years old and you've been obsessed with certain things your whole life, you gather knowledge in that way.
There's a question all the way in back.
I was wondering, you spoke a few moments ago, a couple of comments back about the huge success of Lovely Bones and how it just took off like wildfire. Did that impact you as a writer as you set out to write your subsequent novel?
I would say, you know, anybody who I think this question gets asked a lot of people who had a big success, and sometimes I hear people say, like, no, you know, it didn't affect me, there's no effect, I'm invincible. And I think that is bullshit. I think it did affect me, and I think that the challenge then becomes to stay true to what you were writing, what your obsessions are. You know, so you go through this kind of, it's like taking a body blow in some sense. And, you know, okay, it's a gold-fisted body blow, 'cause it's success. But it's still something that really knocks you off your moorings. And so you have to find your feet again, and basically go back to the exact same weirdo that you were writing about, you know, the same kinds of things that you were always going to write about in the same way that you were always going to write. That's the challenge, and it does take a little while.
We have time for two or three more questions. There's someone all the way in the back, the very back row, right on this side.
I was wondering if your experiences as a child and your relationship with your parents contributed to the fact that you didn't have any children of your own.
the child question. I'm going to be haunted by this. I don't think so. I mean, I mean, as I've said, I have not heard the interview, but as I believe Terry Gross left in the interview that she did with me, I was always open to if a biological clock ever started ticking, you know, and I'd be kind of like, is it going to tick? You know, and I would have one if I felt that urge, but it never did. So I was kind of open to having a child, but I just never really wanted one, I guess. You know, it's as clear as the way I can say it. And I'm so preoccupied by what I do that seems to satisfy me, and I'm very happy that way.
There's someone with two hands up back here, so and then there's just one more question after this one.
Thank you. I was wondering if you could continue to get feedback from rape victims or from parents of children who have been victimized. And I guess I should preface that by saying my coworkers and I work for the Crime Victim Center of Chester County. And just for your information, your book, Lucky, is invaluable to us because we use it as a tool in teaching college courses to raise awareness both for advocates and for victims, as well as for victims who come to our agency, our clients.
Thank you very much. Yeah, I do. I hear quite often. It is one of the unexpected and strange results of the success of The Lovely Bones is that Lucky got to have a life in paperback because it didn't have a life in paperback. And it's kind of a death knell for a book if it doesn't have that life. And, you know, there's something about that success of Lovely Bones that made Lucky get picked up and kind of looked at, and it was a safer thing maybe to go into. And it has a kind of core following that I hear from in a really intense and satisfying way. So, yeah. Thank you.
One more question. One more, we're wrapping up. I guess we're wrapping up. Okay, so thank you all so much for coming, and Alice Siebold will be signing books upstairs in the lobby. Thank you so much.
Thanks.
sure.
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.